My name is Ian Martin Allison. I am here with Sharon Reynolds, and we are here with the incredible Chris Chaney. Now, if you don't know Chris, his resume is absolutely insane. Let's talk about names like Alanis Morissette, Jane's Addiction, Eddie Vedder, Joe Cocker, Glenn Campbell. I mean, it just goes like, I'm looking at the list, it's just like Miley Cyrus, Taylor Hawkins, and the Coattail Riders. It's incredible. We're going to be getting into a bunch of his classic bass lines. We're going to be talking about gear. We're going to be talking about stories, his approach to music. It's going to be amazing. Chris Chaney, thank you so much for being with us today,
man. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. I've watched some of these. Man. I watched one recently with Michael League, and
I
was knocked out. You guys are doing a great job.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we love Michael League, and we love you.
Come on.
Getting prepped for this was so much fun. Sharon and I were watching all these videos, and we were just like, what do we even choose? There's so much. But I want to start out, Sharon, let's pull up the Jane's Addiction Just Because tune. Dude, you have had all of these different sounds over the years. You were sort of a chameleon in the best possible way of bass tones and lines and sounds. And this is like square in your P bass era. I mean, I notice you're playing a P bass right now too. I definitely want to talk about that.
What's interesting that you're bringing this song up is I swear I played this bass on that song. That was around 2003.
Okay.
So it's been about 20 years, and I had just got this bass at a guitar show in Dallas, and it's a 1960 P bass, and I plugged it in. It's like, yep, I'll take it. Like the royal tone, you know?
Amazing. So wait, you roll into Guitar Center. Did you know it was there?
Actually, the story's interesting. A guy in LA named Ricky Mahler, who was kind of a guy that went out and found stuff. I don't think he found it for the Guitar Center, but he just had accessibility. He would travel the country, you know, before vintage gear was so sought after, you know?
Right.
And I think he was in Dallas, called me and said, I found your bass. And I just trusted him. But then if I didn't want it, he was going to take it. So the moment he got back, I plugged it in. I was like, it's mine. I'll take it.
Wow.
You know? That's this bass.
Amazing. Look at this bass.
It's
1960.
Oh yeah. It's such a rad bass. Oh my God. Plays even. And
you played that on this record, on the record.
Yeah. Not on the whole record, but on this song. I got it part way through the record. We were at Henson Recording Studios in LA we were kind of holed up for like 6 months or so.
So cool. Yeah. Well, we want to watch you play it live. You're playing a Lakeland P bass here, but you have like a P bass sound with this amount of grind and this sort of signature sound on this instrument that I just think is amazing. Let's check
awesome.
It out. I mean, this guy too, Navarro.
Navarreach. Oh, damn. I think this was at Terminal 5 in New York.
Oh, cool. I mean, just that bass just simultaneously sits and sticks out. You know what I mean?
Interesting. It was the last song on the record. Bob Ezrin produced it, and he was like, hey, man, we need another song. Come up with the bass line.
Wow. So wait a minute. You came up with the bass line just – did that happen first? Coming up with this bass line?
Yeah. The song was built around the bass line.
Oh.
Yeah. And then Dave came up with that intro guitar part over it. And And then we came up with a pretty adventurous bridge that stepped away from it, you know, just to break it up.
We're going to pull that up too, because we, of course, noticed that. But do you remember that riff off of your, the top of your head?
Oh, yeah. It's a. It's basically the body of it, and it keeps the same. It's just a real like a pedal tone, and or ostinato, right?
Yeah, yes.
And it keeps that going over the chorus too. I just hit octave, so it's like. That kind of thing, right?
Oh, so cool. I mean, and then this bridge is insane. Let's play that.
Just Wow. It's been a minute, though.
It's so great.
No, I got to see if I can remember that.
Yeah, do you remember that?
Something like...
Chris Chaney, just like, let me see if I can remember
no,
that, and then just
like
perfectly
not exactly
saying it.
But it's in that world.
Well, and it sounds like you guys tuned down. Do you guys tune down in Jane's like a half step or whole step?
A half step.
Half step. Okay. Yeah.
It's like a common thing, as you know. It was really for Perry. It's just like to hit high notes as you get older and older. It's
right.
Like just to drop it down a step gives you a little more relief.
I mean, and can you talk about the P-bass gnarliness? I wrote down right here, P-bass gnarliness, all caps, because like you have this thing, how you play with a pick and maybe drive that you choose. Are you choosing a particular like flavor of overdrive when you play with Janes or when you played with them?
Yeah. What's interesting is it's funny you actually asked that, because I have a pedal that's always on, never off. And then I have one it's a step up from there. I have a couple that are step ups from there. Which I rarely even use those, just a couple songs. This pedal is so sought after that they stopped making it. It was a company called Buddha, Scott Sears' company, and he hooked me up initially. I saw it in like a bass player magazine, but it was an expensive pedal, but I loved that it's a Buddha fat bass and has two 12AX7s. So it's got that tube, nice pillowy bottom top end that just bites drive.
Yes.
And I just roll it down enough to where it just gives like a presence and a little gnarliness to the tone, but doesn't overtake it. So it still sits warmly in the track or, you know, on a gig. And got a funny story about it. I just kept that pedal on. I never turned it off.
Do you still do that?
I do. It depends what the gig is. Not in the studio. I'll add that in if I need it. But on the amp side, I love it. It can be a little buzzy here and there, but if you're playing loud enough, that doesn't matter, right?
Yeah, I suppose, right.
I was on a gig once. I was playing with Dave and Perkins, and we were playing in this club, The Dragonfly, in LA, small club, and a fan stole the pedal off the stage. We got off stage, we finished our set. And at the time, I had one backup, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, oh my God, of like everything to take, you took this, and they stopped making them. So Dave, at the time, we have a cover band. It was called Camp Freddy at this time. Now it's the Royal Machines. It's like an all-star cover band. We basically had this radio show with Steve Jones called Jonesy's Jukebox. And Dave was on there and he told the story, and a fan called in and admitted that it was him that stole it.
No.
And I didn't know about this. I was like out at the beach one day and I get a phone call like while the show was happening, like live on the air. I get this phone call. Yeah, we have the guy on the road. He's done a meet, you know, on the corner of Fairfax and Wilcox or wherever it was, somewhere in Hollywood.
What?
And no strings attached. He said he hadn't. Didn't, because Dave brought up the story how bummed Chris was that his pedal got stolen, because you know they stopped making it and you can't find them on Reverb or, you know, and this was years ago. Anyway, I got it back. So he just wanted a piece
of the show.
Yeah, something to connect with. I'm like, well, anything. How about a pick? No,
I know.
Yeah. Or a set list or something. I mean, yeah.
I would have given you a piece before this pedal. I'm not sure.
Did they just drive up and like make the exchange? Or I guess the exchange was just one way. The guy just gave it back?
Yeah, my tech, Dan Cleary, was the one in charge of that. Got it, and no strings attached, no judgment, just give me the pedal. We're happy to have it back. Thank you. Bye.
It's cool that you got it back.
Wow.
Yeah, now I have four of them. I at that point, I just started, I got like a stock from Scott, the guy who owns the company. And
yes.
With Jane's, we always have a backup rig, pedal board. You know, if anything goes south, you're ready to go within a matter of, hopefully like within a minute, you know.
Nice.
You know the drill.
Well, and I mean,
stages live. Oh, yeah. Have to have backup.
Of course. Yes. Well, and now you're mentioning this pedal and the reverb prices are just going to like,
zzz, oh God,
just going to go. You're going to go crazy. I know they will.
It's the blue pedal. No.
Yeah. Did you use this on the Sarah Bareilles track on Love Song?
I think I did, actually. Yeah. But on that, that record was done with this producer who I love. His name's Eric Ross. He had done like Cornflake yeah. Girl with Tori Amos, which is unbelievable.
Yes.
Producer. That's an unbelievable record. And he's been over to my house, and my wife is a hobbyist musician, had this Tone Deluxe, an old Fender amp for guitar. And he remembered it. He goes, Chris, when you come down tomorrow, we're going to start the record. Can you bring your wife's guitar amp? I'm like, what? You don't want me to bring a bass amp? So the whole record was done through a guitar amp. And
whoa.
I played a 1967 M85 semi-hollow body with flat ones, pretty much on that record. There's a song called Bottle It Up. It wasn't obviously the big hit, but it's called Bottle It Up. And I love the tone.
Yes,
the tone he got on that is it's like a perfect bass tone, in my opinion. I loved it. This isn't me. This is his magic, his idea. I'm just a facilitator of this, you know.
Sharon, can we pull up Bottle It Up?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it's such a, got this like hollowy, nasally kind of tone, but still fills out the bottom end. And yeah, I have a mini collection of M85s. So they have semi-hollow body with one pickup. Those are the Fred Hammond, the Dark Star pickups.
Yeah, sure. Yep.
Now that Curtis is making, you know, that a lot of people are, they have that
Novak
really,
stuff.
Yeah, that's that really woolly, kind of just big sound, almost like an EB2 when you kick that impedance. Push that, not, you know what I'm talking about?
It yeah, just sure.
Gives like this.
The huge
20 dBs
in the
bottom end. You're like, whoa.
Wow.
I have one of those that has two pickups. The one I played on her record is a one pickup. Timothy B. Schmidt was in there with the Eagles, and they were next door to us, and it was Joe Walsh's birthday, and we got invited in, and his tech, a guy named Victor, had just delivered an amazing Starfire, like this beautiful green, you could see the wood grain Starfire for Timothy. And Timothy was so cool. He's like, hey, Chris, you want one of those? Hey, Victor, can you get Chris one? Like, as if it was nothing. I was like, I get a call 2 weeks later, and Victor tells me, he goes, I don't know if you're going to want to do this, but I found you a couple basses. I found you a Starfire, and are you familiar with an M85? And I already had one. I was like, oh, yeah. And he said, I don't know if you're going to want to do it. They're in Switzerland, and you're going to have to pay $300 to get them both here. And at the time, I was like, $300? That's nothing. Are you kidding? I mean, I know I don't want to talk about money as if it's nothing, especially these days.
Sure, sure.
But
that didn't seem unreasonable.
For two vintage basses to get them from Europe safely here, $300 is a drop in the bucket. And so I got both of them. They show up, and they were purchased. I got them through a guild rep from the 70s who was a guitar player and had these in his closet. He was like a European guild rep.
Unbelievable.
So they were untouched. They were like beautiful, like played a little, but not really. Yeah. If we do anything else on, you know, bass porn, I can show you some rad stuff.
Oh yeah. We'll have to do a Bass Tales with you. That would be so fun.
Yeah.
I got some good ones.
I know you do. Do you know? I mean, this may be a gauche question to ask. So you just swap me down if you need to. But do you have an idea of the number of bass guitars that you possess, Mr. Chris Chaney?
Over 100, not more than 150.
Dude, that is
It's a lot. Wild. It's a lot. It's I know.
Wow, I shame Ian for the amount of basses he has.
It's to the point where I have like 60 or plus, not anywhere in my vicinity. I have to drive 45 minutes just to access them.
So they're all over the place. Do you have a spreadsheet of where everything is?
I do, actually.
At any moment?
Yeah.
Yeah, I bet you do. You'd have
to, right? It's not that detailed. I just have a list, you know.
Do you ever use that to your benefit to, like, travel lighter? Like, I don't need to bring a bass because I have this one sneakily hidden in this state or something.
Oh, no, I always have to bring one because they're not in that way. The ones where I have the lion's share at a storage facility, but it's like a room with a key so I can actually access it, you know. But no, I always amazing. Still, I travel with a gig bag just like the rest of the base community.
Yeah, that's right.
Checking them.
Dealing with the airline situation.
Yep.
Well, we got to hear Bottle It Up on this M85, yeah. On this Guild base. Let's check it out.
There'll be girls across the nation that'll eat this up. Babe, I know that it's your soul, but could you bottle it up? Get down to the heart of it. No, it's my heart. You're out of your luck. Don't make me tell you again, my love.
Dude. I remember when I heard Love Song, and that was the big monster radio hit. And I remember thinking, oh, things are different now. Like, oh, reality of tracking bass on a pop record is different now. So that's a Guild M85 through this guitar amp. But is it also DI'd? Is it? Oh, did you guys just mic an amp?
That was an Evil back. I haven't been using my Evil Twin as much. It's a great DI. But that was an Evil Twin DI.
Okay.
And I believe the Buddha Fat Bass, I take it back. The Buddha Fat Bass was not on that. That was just the tone of probably more of the amp, honestly.
Oh, wow.
Like if you had to do the blend, I'd say like more in the 70-30 department.
I feel like no one was recording on pop records with that amount of character and drive, at least. And they could have been, right? But did it feel kind of new to you?
No, that's the thing. I was blown away at Sarah's writing and her she just has this incredible range. Her vocals are next level. So that to me is very inspiring. And then you throw in Eric Ross, who's such a great producer. And then I think Matt Chamberlain was on that track. He played on like half the record. And then Brian McLeod, who played on Sheryl Crow's debut. Brian McLeod's a great drummer. I think Brian actually played on the Office theme. He told me, we were doing a session.
Oh, cool.
We were talking about sessions that you've done where you made like nothing, but it went on to be like, you know, an international hit. And
yes.
I made $300 and I played on this thing that, you know, gets played 10 trillion times.
That's crazy. Yeah, I know. We do not have it together like SAG-AFTRA, unfortunately.
Definitely not. Yeah, I still pay my union dues. Why?
Right. I know. Well, here, let's check out Love Song. It's this post-chorus. You hear it. And then into the verse.
That's Bruce Watson on guitar, and he is unreal.
Oh, it's so good. Get this fill right here. Do you remember this bass line? And can you show it?
Not at all.
Yeah.
I mean, that, you know, yeah. I don't remember the minutiae. It was just in the moment. And that was just a take, you know?
Yeah.
Not a lot of punching on that. We probably would do a take or two and... Eric, from my understanding, would probably comp a little bit and cherry pick, you know?
You're almost sliding out of each note to me. It sounds like, ow. And like, do you feel like that was inspired by the grindy sound that you had? So you were kind of like, as I hear the character of the bass in your articulation out of notes?
Probably to be, it's, It wasn't every day that I was doing a record with just a pianist, because the guitar was, there was no guitar on the tracking date. So I was really trying to fill out her left hand and then just add little nuances in there to whatever, just, you know, take it to that next level. So it wasn't just marking her exact left hand, just adding a little flavor in between to elevate it. Yeah.
It's so good.
My funk ball technique sliding out of young, still to this day.
Well, but I mean, that it's so cool. And with combined with that sound, because then you just heard the like, you heard the like grittiness and like tactile texture of the bass. I mean, it really stuck out to me as a choice, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I'm so cool. I mean, even across radio, it really sat in a, like the bass is pretty forward in the mix too. And it sat in a way that felt different than pop records at the time.
Funny. In the moment you're just playing on a project and you don't realize, like when it came out and it went, you know, to the top of the charts, I was like, wow. I remember Matt and I, we weren't in that mindset at all when we were recording. And Tim Pierce, who's, I know you guys know, a fabulous guitar player and one of my favorites. And we were on a session and he said to me, man, that record is the perfect record. That's a perfect record. And I never even really thought about it, honestly.
Wow.
I just liked it. I didn't do a deep, deep dive into it, you know. At that time, it was just like, you know, on to the next.
Right. Yeah, because you're working so much and you're playing with all kinds of folks. And it was like, cool, did that, next thing. So you didn't realize that was going to be a monster.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Do you ever like listen back to it and then you're like, oh, it got so big. I wish I would have done just one or two other things.
Well, that's every single day of my life. Like, I can get down to the minutia of, you know, oh man, I can't believe I didn't do that. Even when I would play, when I was playing with James, Perkins and Dave, they'd work out little things live. And they were so signature that you almost think they're on the record, that when you actually do go back and review or hear the record, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe that's not there.
Yeah. You know,
it's just that experience of playing stuff a lot.
You start to, you know, develops its own identity live.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, hey, we got to check out some Alanis. There's a few things, because we're going back to 98. And this thank you tune that you played on, and we found a really fun performance of it. And jazz bass zone. This is like jazz bass Chris Chaney. This is before you committed, you found your P bass.
Yeah, I don't even think I had a P bass at this time. I love
really?
Jazz. One of my biggest heroes, aside from, even though I play nothing like either of these, Jaco and Marcus Miller.
Yes.
I was obsessed. Daryl Jones also, I have to throw.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the list is long.
Oh, yeah. And so you had, I feel like it's maybe a Sadowski
five-string jazz bass. Marcus, I loved Marcus Miller so much. I sound nothing like him, obviously, but was a huge fan. When I first heard, there was a record, I think it was around like 86 maybe. Mm. I was 16 and I was playing a lot more rock. I was listening to Rush and the Stones and Who and Zeppelin, the Doors. I mean, Hendrix. I mean, just a lot of classic. The Beatles, of course. And then I heard this record. It was a live David Sanborn record. I think it's called Straight to the Heart. And there was a song called Run for Cover.
Of course.
It's like a tour de force of bass on this record. And I heard it. I was like, oh my God, what is that? You know, and so I had to go back to Larry Graham. I worked my way back to like his influences. But Marcus, he changed the landscape for me. That was a long-winded way of saying I love the versatility of a jazz bass.
It's such a great instrument. I mean, it's so cool. And it's really cool to hear you on one too. It's like has all this versatility, like you say, and its own thing. But then it's sort of like when you compare a jazz to a P, you play a P bass, you're like, oh, it's just hard to justify playing a jazz bass sometimes, depending on genre and song.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like the P bass in a mix is so magic. Mm-hmm. But we're going back. We're going to check out the jazz bass. Let's check this out on Thank You. How about me?
I think.
See. Bass sounds good. You sound good, dude.
Thank you.
Everybody's feeling it. Using the B string. I mean, you obviously you're using it a lot here. But were you using the B string in this era a lot? Like, this is the era, I feel like, of five strings. This was like everybody was playing Warwick Streamers. Guitar players were playing PRSs. The pants were big. Were you playing a lot of five string in this at this time?
Yeah, I was, because the range of the songs, you know?
Yeah.
And even... What's funny is I was playing five even if I didn't need it, just because I didn't want to make a bass change. Although that was really more the Jagged Little Pill tour. Mm. And then as I got more in, you know, as the band got bigger, then I had more basses. We started off in a van.
Yeah.
So you know what I mean. You're not bringing five basses out and all the different flavors and options. You get by with what you have. And so at that point, I think that was a little bit later. That was the second or third tour. So yeah, I had a plethora of instruments. I probably had like six basses out on the road. More than
amazing.
Anyone really needs. You only need one.
Yeah.
these days I just tune down every... I was playing on a movie this past week. They're doing another rendition of Roadhouse. Remember the Patrick Swayze movie? They're doing a new version.
Of course I do.
I was playing some cues on that, and there was one point in the queue that it got down to low C, and I just said, you know what, I'm going to tune down just for those four bars on my P bass and not pull out the five string. You know,
right.
I'm not a five hater, but I'm not a five lover. I'm not a five lover either. No.
Well, yeah, you've had these eras. I mean, all these different eras. And so, yeah, no more five string. Do you never bring it anymore?
I on film dates, I bring it just for if you're tracking with multiple people. Just for the speed's sake, I can't lag the session and say, hey, by the way, can we tune up, tune down, and do these drop-in sections, you know?
Right,
and,
right.
But in general, I think there's a resonance to a four-string. Like, Leo Fender got it right the first time. And there's something about the G string and even the D string when you have a five-string. They don't seem to feel the same way or sing the same way, in my opinion. And I'm sure there's a massive argument to this, and people will probably go, what is he talking about? But for me, it's just a feel, the feeling of it. I don't like the tone as much. I just love the way a four-string bass feels, you know?
Yeah, it's so classic. Well, and it's cool, though, to see you, though, in all these eras. And we've got another one, Alanis, you at Woodstock 99 with Alanis doing You Oughta Know. And, like, and I'd never seen this arrangement of you playing, I think, delay bass, like playing with a delay at the top.
Yeah,
you remember this?
Alanis went through like a we played some of this music so much that she wanted to kind of reimagine it and do different versions, you know?
Yeah.
If we had the blue version down, this is the purple version. Yeah.
So let's check it out, Sharon.
Five.
Look at this. Lakeland.
That's a Dunlop tremolo pedal.
What? It's not delay.
No. That's a tremolo pedal. It's one of those purple stereo pedals.
Whoa. I could have sworn. You're blowing my mind. I thought that was delay, but you're just holding the note and the tremolo is taking it.
This was right before the shit hit the fan at Woodstock.
At Woodstock?
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen, there's a documentary.
Oh, of course.
And there is my hero, Gary Novak, on drums.
So
yeah, it was a real mellow version. We didn't kick in on that until the end, and then it went back, segued back to the original, you know?
Well, and when we were looking at this, Sharon was like, how are they keeping in time with this? Are they on a click? Are they like,
no.
Did you just start that and then Gary hung out with you?
That's right. Yeah.
Sick.
Like that was it. Yeah. There was, you know, we didn't have in-ear. Well, I think there were, maybe some people were using in-ears, but that was kind of before everyone was on in-ears and, you know, there was never any tracks or anything like that. So.
Right.
Yeah.
So you just started that thing with that tremolo. How did you get it in time? Was it, did you like tape it down so that it wouldn't get bumped?
I think I had like one of those chalk pens just that marks.
Oh, yeah.
Don't have to totally commit. You could wipe it away, you know. But yeah. God, that song went through different iterations. I remember the first time pulling up, it was the summer of 95, and it was going bananas in the country, the Jagged Little Pill record. And we pulled up to Letterman in a van, and like we were still on a van tour. She had the biggest record in the country, but we were still just playing like the clubs around the country, just, you know, and then it excelled quickly from there. But that version, I remember someone sent it to me recently and said, remember this? And I hadn't watched it. Like, I don't know. I just don't think I'd ever watched it on YouTube. Now everything's available. And my hair is hilarious. I'm moving my foot, like trying to imitate Daryl Jones, who was my hero. Everyone else in the band was like into Jane's Addiction. I was still in my jazz head. I was just like,
amazing.
Learning Jaco lines, you know? That was a really special time that we had. That next summer, Radiohead opened up. They were on the Benz tour, and like, Alanis was so big that she kind of got to cherry pick who was gonna. Oh, everyone wanted to open up just to get in front of that many sold out shows. So Radiohead had not recorded OK Computer yet, but they were just about to go in the studio right after that tour, their first record with Nigel. So every night we would stand out there, and Alanis fans were not necessarily the biggest Radiohead fans. People at concessions buying T-shirts and Cokes. And I remember just standing out there. Taylor and I were obsessed. We'd be out at the front of house just watching them every night, and they were just fine-tuning OK Computer. And I always have a fondness for the Benz. When people go, what's your favorite Radiohead record? I mean—
Oh, I love that record.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a fan of all of it, but it was really special to be there. We used a Hi8 or Super 8. We'd record the shows, you know.
What? Yeah, you and Taylor together?
Yeah, we would— Every show we'd be out front. That same tour, we opened up for Neil Young in Europe. And I remember going out front of house after we played. We were, I think, at Bercy in France, in Paris. And he had put back, you know, Crazy Horse together. And we did our show. Then Neil Young comes on. And at one point, Billy, the bass player, it's just going for like 20. It was honestly, it was like 12 minutes. The lights were all red, and the drums go just playing this. Not one variance. It was just
whoa.
It was literally like, and Neil just ripping, and we're like, okay, that's how it's done. We're like half pint chumps. These are the cats.
You mentioned Taylor Hawkins, and, you know, we mentioned him at the top, too, because you played with Taylor in the Coattail Riders, but, of course, with Alanis, and, you know, he recently passed away. And I just wonder if you can speak to that friendship, the camaraderie, the musicianship you guys had when it started, and with Alanis specifically. Like, you guys seem to be thick. And what that relationship meant to you?
Well, yeah, Taylor was, I mean, he, it's hard to even talk about, but I don't know someone who loved music more than Taylor. Mm. So he just was the most motivated person. He would wake up before anybody every day. I would get calls. My wife called him The Other Wife. And when we had our side project, she wanted us to name the band The Other Wife. And I thought it was amazing. Kind of a funny thing. Like you go into a gig, what are you guys doing tonight? We're going to go see The Other Wife, you know? Right. Anyway, yeah, he would wake me up and go, Janie, you're still in bed, damn it. I've already done 100 burpees, you know? Like he just would motivate you, kick your ass, and he had already written a song or have a stem for a song, an idea, you know? Come up with a chorus for this. Here's the verse or vice versa, you know?
Wow.
And he just had this energy that was infectious and the biggest heart. So for him to not be here is a massive thing. When he passed, I basically said no to touring. I actually left Jane's Addiction the day after I got the news. I just couldn't do it, you know. That had a pretty profound effect on me, you know. But
yes,
he was just an energy ball, and he had chops up the yin yang and could play anything and sing. What he could sing and play, our band would tour with Nate Wood and Gannon Arnold, and I think people now know Nate, if you're a fan, who's one of the greatest musicians alive. Amazing. He would play rhythm guitar and do background singing. And no one at that time even knew his prowess on the drums. You should hear him play bass. He plays bass with Wayne Krantz. He can play any instrument.
Crazy.
Prolifically.
Wow.
In fact, he's also, a side note, just to give Nate some props, is he masters records. And he's one of the best. He masters... My kids are both musicians, and he'll text me and go, "Wow, your kids sound pretty good, man." You know, he just mastered their music.
Cool.
You know, but that band was a really killer band. Taylor would go, "Man, we were the best band. Oh man, check out this." And he'd send me a show. You know, we opened up. I remember doing a show with him once. We were in Belgium on a Coattail Riders tour, and we were the first band of the day, and it's in a field. We're on the main stage going on at like noon, and there's not one person. And we have like a 25-minute set. And we walk out on stage, and they open the gates. I'm like, why are we going on? There's nobody even here. And the gates open up. And by the second song, there was already like 10,000 people. People were just charging in, jockeying for position so they could be there for the headliner, like Pearl Jam, you know, 6 hours later, 8 hours later.
And sure, yes.
We did that show, and that was one of the best gigs we ever had. We were just like, there was a synergy, a connectedness that was on point. And we got in a car after that gig and we drove to France from Belgium and did another gig. Like we had two in one day. Like we were real, and we were in a van.
Crazy.
Like a sprinter.
Yeah.
You know, loading all of our own stuff. Taylor's setting up his drums. It wasn't, definitely not a bougie tour.
Right.
It was one of the most fun experiences I've ever had musically. Because we were just, you know, we had, at one point we had people on the side of the stage, like John Paul Jones and Grohl. They were out with them, Crooked Vultures.
And, oh, wow.
And Grohl would bust my balls and go, "Dude, John Paul Jones is on the side of the stage. He's checking your shit out. You better not fuck up." You know, that kind of stuff. I'd be like, "Oh my God, talk about heroes."
That's incredible. You know? Oh yeah. Yeah. Wow, man. I remember you guys did a tour and I think you came through Minneapolis. I have good friends that played in a band at the time called Dropping Daylight. And they, I think, maybe opened for you, the Coattail Riders. And I remember my friend Sebastian, who's in that band, said he started to talk to you about basses. And he said, "Oh yeah, I've got a friend that's got, you know, really is into basses." And that you mentioned, "Oh, I'm really into basses as well." And I remember Sebastian, my friend, calling me saying, "Chris Chaney has like 100 basses."
Oh,
and I'm
my
like,
God.
"What? That is outrageous." Because you guys started to talk bass collection. Oh, it was just so cool.
Yeah,
but it's amazing that you were out with your friends, you know, like out on the road with your best friends. That's a pretty special thing.
Yeah. Yeah. We had just, before he passed, we had just mixed and mastered a record. We had a trio project called NHC, which was just our initials. It was kind of like a play on, in high school, my first band, really in eighth grade, I had a band called THC. And
yes.
Tompkins, Halden, Chaney.
nice. Yes.
And we were having so much trouble coming up with a name. And Taylor's like, "Fuck it. Let's just be, we're just NHC. We deserve that at this point in our careers." You know, he had that kind of.
Yeah, sure. Yes.
And I was never the biggest fan of that name. I just wanted to have more. I like The Other Wife. No.
But, The Other Wife is great.
You know, but we just said, you know what? It doesn't matter. We're just going to, you know. We just love making music together. So that was done in the can, and we did two shows, and you know, and the rest, you know, he passed on tour, obviously. And
yes,
you know, I have nothing to say other than I just love the guy, and he's up there rocking with Bowie. I guarantee it.
Absolutely.
He was playing. Here's one. How about this? You know that?
I wish I did. I could pretend and try
Black
to
Country,
that
Black
of course.
One of his favorite Bowie records. That was Black Country Rock off of Man cool. Who Sold the World.
Oh, it's so cool.
Oh, yeah.
Do you play a lot with a pick? Like, give me a split of fingers to pick. Like, give me the split range.
I don't know. That's a tough one. Whatever it's called for. I love playing. I play a lot with my nail, too. You know, not like Bernard Edwards. He's one of my heroes, too, by the way.
Yes.
But I like this is with just a nail. You know, that kind of thing. Or what I like about it, you can always tuck a pick away and still use your fingers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But the nail still has a bit of bite versus the pick.
Sounds so good.
Here's a pick.
Scrapier.
Yeah, but I can go.
Right.
Like, I like mixing it up, you know?
Yeah.
And then I also have the access, you know, to fingers and drop the pick, you know, by playing.
Sure.
You know. Anyway, I don't know. 50-50 maybe? I don't know.
Yeah.
I had to learn. When I got the call for Jane's Addiction, I was actually in Martha's Vineyard, and cell phones were, like, as thick as a brick. And it was the first call, and it was Stephen Perkins. I didn't even know how he had my number. And he called my wife, and there was no cell reception. The phone didn't work except in this one little area. And I was standing like in Carly Simon's on, you know, acreage in Martha's Vineyard. Mm. And he goes, "Hey man, what are you doing? You want to come down to the studio? Blah blah blah. We're doing a record with Bob Ezrin." I was like, "Oh my God, you're not going to believe it! I just got the Martha's Vineyard, and I'm here for a week." And they had some shows, and the first shows were like Reading and Leeds, massive shows in England.
Wow.
And I didn't play much with the pick. And I'm a huge Eric Avery fan. We used to play, I mean, just a side note, on the Jagged Little Pill tour. Taylor was the biggest Jane's fan. The fact that I ended up getting the gig with Jane's just blew his mind. Anyway, I would play those songs during soundcheck, you know, some of the signature riffs like Mountain Song or 3 Days, Up the Beach.
Yeah.
You know, Had a Dad. Yeah. We would just jam that stuff at soundcheck. And the fact that I ended up getting a gig with them is just like weird cosmos in alignment, small world. I don't even know how to explain it. But anyway, fast forwarding back to right before I got the gig, I couldn't be there to rehearse, nothing. So Perry calls me. I'd met Perry once on the Lannis tour. But Perry goes, "Man, you can't be here. You better nail it." Like, just, I was like, oh. I was in the back. I was on tour at that time. I was doing a record with Carly Simon and then playing with her son, Ben Taylor. And we were doing a mini tour and on the East Coast. I was in the back of the van with my bass, just headphones on, playing with the pick, trying to get my pick chops. And meanwhile, Eric is all pick. And that's his thing. And those lines are like nursery rhymes to me. Those bass parts are, you play, you know, so fun to play them. I always tried to honor exactly as close as I could to what he did, because it wasn't broken. Don't try to fix it. You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure.
And
we actually have a fun, little fun video of you playing Caught Stealing.
Yeah, that was being down in South America playing those lines. I mean, they sing the line, it's almost like a soccer chant, you know, like playing Mountain Song.
Yes. And while Sharon's pulling that up, what's your favorite Eric Avery bass line?
God, that's a tough one. I actually don't even have a favorite. I love them all. They're all like equally. I mean, 3 Days.
Yes, 3 Days.
If I have to pick one, I love Then She Did as well. But three days is just masterful.
You just have your signature sort of grindy P bass thing. I wonder if it's the Buddha. We'll see if you remember this show. Hey, hey, hey.
I was just dragging when I was playing it just now.
How many of you out there love to steal? There's something
Perry.
Good about it.
All of us.
It's almost like all of us.
Man, is that sound the always on Buddha pedal that you were using?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. I was an early adopter of Aguilar, by the way, too. I have just noticed you when you played that Woodstock footage, I had the most ridiculous bass rig at that time. I had like two of those power amps, which are, and then on two of the preamps, but then on top of that, there was like a 359 head, which is half the power amp side, which one of my favorite heads. They stopped making it. I just don't think there's much of a market for a head that costs over $3,000, unfortunately.
Right.
You know what I mean? But
sure,
that was when Alex Aguilar was making that, you know, on Broadway in New York. I remember going to I started playing their heads, excuse me, before they even had cabinets. They were,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
So were you playing through Eden cabs then?
Yeah.
Because I feel like I've seen some, yes, Aguilar heads with Eden cabs.
Exactly.
Right?
And as soon as they came out with cabinets, no offense to Eden, I just really liked what Aguilar were doing at that time. And I had to switch over. I like the continuity.
Yeah.
Kept saying, come on, where are the speakers, guys?
Right. Let's make some cabs. Do you still play Aguilar stuff?
I do. Yeah. I mean, I have in the studio, I sometimes have a B15 or an SVT. It just depends. I have a bunch of different amps, but generally I love Aguilar and I've been playing it since the 90s. I have like early serial numbers, you know, like serial number 8 of like the 628 and, you know, like these old.
That's so cool.
Like the 5th 359.
Oh, man.
They're still working.
Break those out and play them?
Yeah, I use them.
Yeah?
I have a studio in my basement in LA and that's my go-to. I have that. I have a B15 and an old SVT. Those are kind of like my heads. I even have like an old Fender head. Just different flavors, you know?
Right.
So like whatever's right. I basically have this little thing called a JX44. It's like an amp switcher, but I use it in the studio. It's made by Radial. And I have four bass. I don't use it in the live set. I just use it in the studio. And I have four amps always on, plugged in, so I can just kind of toggle between them.
Always mic'd up, ready to go.
Yeah. Why? Okay. So the dirty little secret is I have one cabinet. I actually have more than one cabinet, so it's just like a switch swap out of a, you know, a cable just to access that cabinet.
What cabinet do you use all those heads through then?
I have, believe it or not, right now in the studio, I have just like a Fender 410.
Cool.
That's what's, and it sounds amazing. I put a Neumann FET 47 right up close to it, and I love the sound. The chain I've been using is very, very over-the-top bougie chain. I was talking about it earlier.
Break it down, man. We want to know.
Yeah. So I'm going through a 359 Aguilar head and into a Unfairchild, which is by a company called Undertone Audio. For people who don't know that, it's a guy named Eric Valentine, who's to me a legendary producer who did like Songs for the Deaf, Queens of the Stone. He's done a lot of All Star by Smash Mouth. So I was working on a Slash record at his studio. He sold it, but he had a studio called Barefoot in LA. And at that time, Slash was recording this record over the course of maybe like 9 months. Every 3 weeks, we get together and record a song. It was with a different artist. And Eric was unveiling his Undertone Audio project. He's working with this guy, and he's just in an immense deep well in the gear world on top of being a prolific producer. So
yeah.
I got one of his Unfairchilds, and it's a stereo. It's like a old 670. So I put the amp side through half and the DI through the other half, and those go into some Pultec EPQ 1As, which are just, man, they sound sweet. And that's it.
And I
go into a Neve 50, 52. Are you familiar with those mic pre's?
No, I mean only 1073s, but
they're a new.
I'm sure it's wonderful.
I have some 1073s in like a rack, but I have a small 5088 console which is a recent purchase. It's like kind of like dream purchase, waiting my whole life to get something like this. And
wow,
boy, is it. I think I added up like the, I won't even disclose the number, like, because a Fairchild's like 10 grand or more, you know, like when you start dividing this thing up, it's not attainable. Just like
six figure bass chain.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's comedy.
Do you find that you take like run all that processing or run through all that gear? Do you ever do like a clean option, or are you always just running that? Is that chain your clean option? And then dirt comes from the mic'd up amps.
Exactly. I would throw something on the amp side. I usually go pretty clean on the DI, because these days, I mean, I was working on a Billy Idol record recently, and the producer hit me to the Dark Glass plugin. I don't know why I didn't. I have some of those Dark Glass pedals, which are incredible. And
yes,
he just wanted the cleanest sound. And he also has the Fairchild at his house. So I had a really royal bass tone, and he just added the most gnarly grit. He also had this other pedal that Jack Black makes. Jack White. What am I talking about? Jack
Black. I was going to say, like, Jack Black makes pedals?
The best pedals going. Come on, man.
Yeah.
White. It's Triple Graph. It's by, what is the company?
I know the Copper Sound.
Yeah, Copper Sound.
Or Copper.
That's it.
Is that right? Yeah.
The Copper Sound. Yes. Copper Sound. And it's like this up an octave pedal. I used it on every track on the second half of this record. We just turned it on, kind of like the Buddha, and didn't turn it off. And I played a new Castedosa bass, which I'm a huge fan of.
Yes.
Carlos. Josh Klinghoffer turned me on to him. He was a master builder at Fender. And he's known for his, he makes one of the sweetest baritone guitars. And he has a Raza Select, a Raza fuzz circuit in the baritone. And I was playing it backstage at an Eddie Vedder gig, and Josh goes, "Oh man, you sound good on that. You like it?" And I was like, "Oh, this is coming from my hero. Yeah, I'm going to get you one of those." He was tight with Carlos. And then when he started making, I saw his first bass, I called Carlos. I'm like, "I have to get one. In fact, I have to get two. I want one with flats and one with rounds." And so I picked those up and fell in love. It's one of my, I probably should have brought that, so you could hear when you're in LA, you'll have to come by.
I'd love to.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, 1960 P bass is no slouch too.
Nothing's going to beat this. That's the truth.
Well, and you mentioned Eddie Vedder, and right before we rolled, you told me the most outrageous story that I'm going to make you repeat, because Eddie Vedder apparently bought you a gift.
Well, we were up in his hometown in Seattle, and we were doing a couple nights, and on the first night, we have a jam room backstage, and I was in there jamming with the other guys. It was an amazing band. There was Chad Smith on drums, Josh Klinghoffer on guitar and vocals, and Andrew Watt, who produced the record, who's another just ridiculous talent. And
monster, yes.
I think we were just like jamming some Hendrix, and then Eddie has his little like piano in there and a guitar set up, and he comes in, and he's holding this old-looking gig bag. And we stopped playing. He goes, "Chris, you ever seen one of these?" And I hadn't. I didn't even know they made gig bags for 1953 P basses. And that's what it was, an empty gig bag. And he goes, "You know, I thought you might like this." Because on that, to go back just a little bit, on that tour, we were doing like maybe an 11 show tour. And Josh, Andrew, and I would hit all like the vintage shops. You know, we're in Chicago, we go to the Music Exchange. And so he was like, "Oh my God, all you guys talk about is vintage gear."
And right, got it.
So he gives me the gig bag, and I was emotional. I was like, "Oh my God, this is incredible. I could not believe it."
So cool.
And it had
one of those original form-fitted leather kind of.
Yeah, and it's like a maroonish color. I wish I had a picture of it. You could probably look it up. Man, but
we'll find one. We'll find
one. Yeah, and what's crazy is I got a 1953 P bass from Dave Boonshoft, who's the original owner of Aguilar.
Sure. Right.
And who was he was a session bass player in New York. And I've known Dave for going on three decades. And I go, "Oh my God, how did he know that I have 53? And this matches, I don't have it." And then he walks back in a couple of minutes later with the bass. So I have two 1953 P basses. Like, talk about rubbing salt in. Sorry. No.
Dude. But Eddie Vedder bought you a 53 P bass.
It was an incredible gift. It was the most inc- incredible display of his spirit, kindness, generosity, and he wrote a card, and I was like welling up just reading it. He's like, to use a backgammon analogy, you know, when I'm on stage with you, I feel like I'm rolling double sixes, and I, you know, it was just like so flattering. And then I made about 50 clams that night. Just kidding. No. I literally went out, and he has a song called In the Dark, and I just thought it would be perfect on that, and yeah, pulled it out, and it just had that tear. That's the most insane gift.
Dude, it's just insane, and it just speaks to your character, to how you take so seriously your craft, your vibe on the road. Like, it just – I remember seeing footage of Taylor talking about you, and I was trying to find this video, but it's basically him just singing your praises and talking about, like, hey, you need something like rock and roll with a pick, call Chaney. Hey, you need something that swings, call Chaney.
Oh,
like,
God.
Whatever you can think of, call Chaney. Do you know this thing that I'm talking about? I saw it years ago.
I edited it. And it's just... it was actually him going, call Tim LaFave. Call Tim LaFave.
That's great. No, no
one
way.
Of my favorites.
Yeah, of course. Me too. But you're not getting out of this one, man.
Come
it was
on.
You for sure. And I'll tell you, like, you know, that just seems to come up, right? I mean, with all these players that you – or all these artists that you've toured with and played on records, producers that you've worked with, can you – for anybody that wants to be a side musician, be a session musician, be a touring musician, can you speak to something that has been just so critical in you getting these gigs, keeping these gigs, having Eddie Vedder give you a 53 P bass? Like, what is it about you that you feel like that's happening? And how can you pass that along to future generations that want to do that for artists?
My recipe, everyone's got a different recipe. And mine was just working as hard as I could and having, there's three things I always name. I learned this from a guy named Keith Devlin, who's a mathematician. I think he is at Stanford, and he's authored like 27 books on math. So yeah. I just related music is so math based, all numbers, rhythms, all that. And he said, to have success today, you have to have passion, focus, and commitment. You can throw in 100 other adjectives and truly, you know, but to distill it down to those three, he's right. So I feel like I had those, and I still do. I have passion, I love music, I'm committed to it, and I'm focused, and I wake up and I still have a love for it. To quote Perry Farrell, I'm a lifer. Like, I'll do this till the day I die. I just love music.
Yes.
And the fact that I can, you know, have a 1960 P bass and my bass collection and all this outboard gear and, you know, tools of the trade is beyond. I'm just blessed. I don't take it for granted. But you have to work hard.
Yeah.
You have to have a true love for it, you know? And
yes.
It's hard. I think the pandemic kind of pushed, if it's like a massive pizza, like now the center pepperoni is like what the music industry is now, and the rest is hobbyists. It's just, it's hard. This is a tough industry. So you have to work harder than the rest. And I don't think I'm not hip to the countless, ungodly good, redonkulously badass bass players that are like 11 years old out on.
I know.
And I don't even like, with four of my fingers, I don't have the chops that some of them have with one. I swear.
Right.
That's the truth. Yeah. You know?
And sure.
So I don't know. I just work hard, have true love for it. Be a good person.
Of course. Yes. You know? Like, the hang is huge. And I'm sure you're prepping. You have to be preparing for this stuff. Like when Perry said to you, you better nail it. I mean, and you're in the back of the van, you know, working on your pick chops. You prioritize nailing it. You must.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Because I think part of, like, I try to take everything as if I'm actually in the studio recording, and I just don't want to flub. And, you know, I mean, right. Mistakes are fine. I make mistakes every song. There's some little, if I really get down to the, you know, analyze things on like the micro level. But I used to let that stuff bother me. And now it just adds to the feel and flavor of whatever. There's a great David Bowie story with, I'm a big fan of Trevor Boulder, played with Uriah Heep, and he's on, you know, Ziggy and some of the classic recordings. He was playing on Gene Genie, and There's a double chorus. If you listen to it, it's not a mistake, but it is a mistake. Like, he doesn't go to the double chorus. He goes back to the root or to the verse. Mm. And they were playing it live, and they kept that on the record. So then they're playing it live on like a TV show, and he plays it right now. Now he knows it. And David stopped and said, "Hey, you're playing it wrong. Play it like the record." And I was like, wow. You know,
that's amazing. You know, right? So, like, that attention.
And he's
to
one of my heroes. And there's like mistakes. Mm-hmm. I've heard countless little, you know, bloopers, whatever you want to call them, mistakes, whatever. They're not really, though. If you, even on Ziggy Stardust, he plays an F to the G instead of, you know, it's like, you know, he plays done.
Oh yeah,
and everyone, I'll play that, and I've had guitar players go, "Hey, dude, no, it's an F sharp." I'm like, "No, it's not."
Right. Oh, I love that.
But he does put an F sharp at other points in the song. You know, that's not a mistake. That's the record that we love.
Right. And there's this idea, right, that like records, you have to assume that records were intentional because you have the ability to go back and change things. And so those choices that made it, you know, in certain cases, it's just what the band played that day. But like thinking, holding those parts dear, right, and thinking about them as intentional, not just like, oh, whatever, and I'll do my thing. I think artists, I mean, you know, I'm sure, really appreciate that level of detail in you and in like how you prepare and how much of a fan of music you are.
100%, you know? Yeah, I like to do a deep dive. And I think one of the areas that a guy like yourself and I didn't have an advantage is – we came up before, at least I came up way before YouTube. And
of course, yes.
These days, you can watch 100 different ways and sideways to play anything. And then on top of that, there's like multi-tracks and isolated bass parts on everything. So there really is no excuse. If you're in that learning phase where you're trying to cop somebody else's, like, I'm going to learn Crazy Train, exactly what Bob Daisley played.
Yeah.
There's no denying it. That is the
denying it, right? Yeah.
John Entwistle, you know, hearing him do Bob O'Reilly, and you're like, oh my God.
I know.
Or Won't Be Fooled Just Again. Amazing. Oh my God. There's like a multi-track of that out there.
I mean, that Entwistle stuff's crazy. I mean, and John Button was just in right before we started this, and just, you know, talking to him about having to deal with, wow, what to commit to and play those parts, and then what, you know, there's so many different versions. And I mean, he said that like The Who, a lot of times on studio records, it really was like, what did John want to play that day?
Yeah.
Because it would really change live. And, you know, but then you just have to cobble together this sort of performance of all of these different versions.
Exactly.
Right? It's pretty cool.
Yeah,
pretty cool.
Bob Ezrin, for people who don't know, a legendary producer, he like introduced Tony Levin to Peter Gabriel.
Wow. You know,
he recorded Berlin, Lou Reed, arguably one of his most influential records, did The Wall by Pink Floyd, little record. And
he was
friends with John and would just tell me, you know, the Ox was for his strength, Thunder Thumbs. The guy could just, not Thunder Thumbs, I'm thinking of Louis Johnson, but
yeah,
some of my heroes have these names, the Ox.
Yeah,
and
the Ox.
Oh, man. Yeah. Oh, quick side note. When we were in the studio, I remember having on the Strays record, I had this tone. Brian Virtue, the engineer, and I were so stoked on it. It was like the best bass sound I could comprehend. I was like, oh, my God. And Bob Ezrin walks in and he goes, nah, I don't know about that tone. And I go, oh, man, what are you thinking, Bob? And he goes, you know what? I'm going to pull out the bass that Roger played on The Wall. And I was like, what? And this is like halfway through the record or deep into the record.
Whoa.
So I'm waiting around for like 30 minutes. It's in his vault at Henson and it comes out. And I'm like, oh my God, that's the bass. And I plug it in.
Whoa.
And it hadn't been played since then. And so it did not. It sounded, even though it's an amazing bass, but piece of history, it didn't sound great. And I love Bobby. Yeah. He goes, go back to what you had. Yeah, he used to sing you know, I'd love working with someone like that, just the stories, but he would talk about Entwistle and just, I mean, God, we can all bow down. And rock bass, all you have to do is listen to Live at Leeds, and that goes right to what you were saying, the difference between a recorded version and then their live show. On any day,
crazy.
It could just be, wakes up and has no coffee, wakes up and has three cups, you know.
And it's a whole different show.
Yeah.
Yes.
Crazy.
Scott really wanted me, he was like, hey, when you talk to Chaney, you have to ask him about Carole Kay. And so I wanted to ask you, did you take a couple of lessons with Carole Kay?
It was a late night discussion. I was with a buddy of mine, and I somehow found myself going down the rabbit hole of LA Motown.
Yeah.
They're moving their operations from Detroit, and Carole Kay saying that she played bass on Ain't No Mountain High Enough. And I'm like, no, that's James Jamerson. Right. I mean, it's even in the book. I know that's Jamerson. You can tell that's James Jamerson.
Sure.
And there was this article, and I get to the bottom of it, and she did play bass on it, and she told me herself, but she, you know, that was not the record version. And it was when they were moving the operation to LA. So at the bottom of this article is her email. And I'm like, what? Or a website or whatever. I click on it and it goes to her website and it says lessons. And this is after I had done a record with Glenn Campbell.
Yeah.
And like people who don't know Glenn Campbell, he was unbelievable guitarist in the Wrecking Crew, played on countless records. He's told me these great stories. And we could talk for 10 years.
Oh, I know. Wichita Lineman is one of my favorite songs of all time.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Oh, yeah. All the Jimmy Webb masterclass in songwriting. Yeah.
Yes.
So Carole, I reach out and it's like midnight and I get a response at like 12:02. And she goes, I'm available Tuesday from, 10 to 11 and 12 to 1 and Wednesday. And she gave me like six lesson options and I just picked one. I'm like, okay, this works for me.
Yeah.
And I drove up to her place and knock on her door. And she's like, Chris, come on in. I'm just getting out of the shower. And I walk in and she goes, plug your bass in and start walking Autumn Leaves. Just quarter notes.
Wow.
And I'm just like, whatever. Oh. I don't even know the changes right
now. Yeah, I love it.
And I'm just like, yes. Walking and she's just listening. She comes down and she never picked up a bass, just played guitar. She's an amazing guitarist and on top of such a great bass player. And I loved, she just had such an old school. I mean, she is old school. She just had this teaching style. Well, the way she talked a lot about Joe Pass, the way Joe would do it. I would talk about, augmented, like the five chord and all the options you have on that, on the dominant, going back to the tonic.
Yes.
And she would show me how to play a whole tone scale or the arpeggio. And I had all, in my head, like there's not one way, there's a gazillion ways, infinite.
Yeah,
and
sure.
She was just showing me like classic Joe Pass whole tone lines that would get you back to the tonic,
Oh, and cool.
I just have these great, I just did that one lesson though. I had like my little brief encounter into the Wrecking Crew world through that. And it was special. So, yeah. She's prolific.
So cool. Oh, she's the best. And hey, I have to ask too, one other thing is, you mentioned the Entourage theme and I know you've played on all of these films but that's not something that I feel like a lot of people know is that you can read and that you can do film cues.
Yeah.
And can you just talk about that a little bit?
It's a interesting thing. Cause my grandma, I would visit her in the summers. I was like 5 years old and she was astride like ragtime, very into Scott Joplin, had the Scott Joplin songbook and taught me the notes of this well before bass was in, my eyes. And I just learned the notes. And I think maybe at that age, you're like a sponge and it's just, you're so impressionable that it stuck. So when I got some bass, lessons from an amazing teacher named Steve Evans when I started, who actually was Juan Aldretti's teacher.
Oh,
Juan used
cool.
to say, yeah, you study with Steve Evans. And I remember him teaching me like John Scofield lines, and I didn't even know they were John Scofield. He would show me like bass parts. And so I go to Boston, to Berkeley, and you had to know how to read. And there are people who just didn't, and they were learning like in starting at square one. And I had a leg up because right. I already knew the notes. So then I fast forward to LA, and I'm just doing gigs and not a lot of calls. And I did get a call. Randy Jackson was my first kind of break. He couldn't make a session. And Stephen Bray, who wrote Get Into the Groove, Madonna. I mean, this is back in the early 90s. And I show up, and there's like a 5-page synth bass chart, 16th note notated. And they're like, can you slap this and double the synth?
Oh, my
like
that, God.
But you got to remember, like I said earlier in this interview, I was a huge Marcus fan. So it was like right. that sound. Like, oh, you had to double the synth part. But then I looked at it. It wasn't too rocket science. I could do it. But that was my first kind of break. I remember Kurt Biscara being on drums and a guitarist who's passed named Greg Aragain, who was prolific, played with Seal. That was basically the rhythm section that played on Seal's first record, Crazy.
Oh. And yeah, the bass player,
I think Doug Wimbish. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So I was just like a sub. And that led for Stephen Bray to call me. And I did a gig with Christopher Cross and Rita Coolidge. And it just led to a few things that, as you know, it's like it's just all who you know. And if you're prepared right. and hopefully don't flounder on the gig, do a good job and be a good person.
Do you remember any of that slap bass line? Did you play? Did you track bass on that? Oh,
I did.
Come on,
I couldn't remember. It was written, but you know, I had gone through my. Is that even on?
Yes.
All that stuff. You know, I don't slap that much anymore. But I remember being fascinated by Marcus. I couldn't figure out that he does like this 30-second little like hiccup.
Yes.
And it was so simple, even though it wasn't, because it was just so fast. Yeah. It was just. Mm-hmm. That's all it is.
Sure.
That's all it is. And I couldn't for the life of me. And then he's a drummer, which I learned so much from Gary Novak, that he makes everything, you know, all the eighth notes, 16th notes, right?
Right.
With that left hand.
With the left hand slap.
Yeah. So if you're playing just anything like, he would fill it in and subdivide it and go, so.
Right.
Simple as that. Right.
Yes.
So you're, so subdividing. That's why if a lot of good drummers can just pick up a bass and noodle around with the slap style just because of their technique with sticks, you know?
Right. They've got that like, two-hand independence thing going
exactly.
on. You're treating the bass like drums. Man.
Yeah, so I started incorporating so that cool. kind of stuff into like my finger playing. Like, you know, these like licks. I loved Paul Jackson.
Yes.
You know, like I just got into everybody. There was no one right. I didn't like. Jack Bruce to like Dave Holland, to Mingus, to Paul Chambers, to Ray Brown, to... Like, I mean, the list, I mean, to Steve Harris. I mean, you know, I was like, oh my God.
Oh, yeah. Sharon loves that.
Hell yeah.
I just like,
oh,
for me, if it's good, it's good. I was never like a musical snob. I love The Cure and I love Mozart. You know what I mean? I think.
Well, it seems like you also like your inner music fan seems to still be driving the bus.
Yeah.
And you have a wide sense of what is good. Like, you know, a lot of people say that like, oh, I like good music, but they have a narrow, I perceive that they have kind of a narrow, they're saying it because they think a lot of shit is bad. But you are like, oh, I like good music. Basically, I feel you saying like, I like this huge spectrum of music. You're finding the good. You're uncovering the good in music. And it's just, I feel like it's got to be part of why so many people love you, Mr. Chris Chaney.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you. I mean, I'm as big a fan of a guy like Max Martin. Like to me, he is untouchable. He's just
I know.
Prolific. prolific. The art and what he does. My son is a producer, and my daughter's a songwriter, and just hearing what they do, and he's done such a deep dive, you know, with the technology today and the accessibility of so many of the whatever production tricks, and hear one sound and it's really layered. It's like four different keyboard sounds and that makes the one sound. I remember seeing like a special with Dr. Luke talking about like some Katy Perry records and how they, you know, approach some of the sonic palette of that and being like, wow, it's not just like you're flipping on a Juno, you know, 106 or 60 and it's just this.
Right.
It might be, but it's like a deep dive. And there's a whole other art in that world. And so there's never a lack of things to get inspired by, you know, if you're open to it.
Oh, yes. That's a good word for people, you know, that want to do this too, is like, you have to stay interested. You have to stay inspired. And there's never a lack.
Yeah, there's so much amazing music out right now. I mean, it's incredible. So I'm just such a fan, and that's where I think I get my inspiration.
Hey, if people want to support you, all the people checking this out, where can they go to best do that? Can you give us some socials or some websites to best support you? Like, where do people go to check you out?
This is now we're going down lazy lane. My name, I think it's Chris Cheney Bass on Instagram. That's really it. Yeah. I had Facebook. I never really went on it. And I'm not on TikTok. I think I might have. I'm just not a big social guy. I think at one point I might still own my name, you know, through like GoDaddy, but I never made a website or any of that. I just, you know, I'm not the best self-promoter, I'll be honest. You know, these days I know everyone is, you know, daily. It's like it's like a meal every day. You got to do this, do that. I'm a little older and just didn't, you know, get on that bus, but that's the truth. So just Chris Cheney Bass on Instagram is it, but I should be posting more regularly. There you go.
No worries. It's just a gift when you do. When I see you pop up, I'm always thrilled. I'm such a huge fan. I mean, we're big fans of you at SBL.
You guys. You kidding?
Man.
I love what you guys are doing.
We would love to get you back in and talk about that bass collection as well. And
anytime.
I feel like everybody watching is going to be like, yes, please. Let's see some of the gems from the bass collection. Oh, so we'll do that.
100%.
But yeah, Chris, this has been amazing. Man, thank you so much for your generosity and your spirit and your time. You're the best. Thank you.
Oh, man. Thank you. No, you guys are moving the needle forward in the bass community, and I'm honored to even be sitting here talking to you. Seriously. Thank you.